Good evening, everyone. My name is Jamie Neen. I work with Mining Watch Canada, and it is my great pleasure to... Well, I won't welcome you all here. I will join you all here, and I will ask Monique Manache to give us a more formal welcome.
Pajoshe, welcome. Monique Manache, Indishnikos. Algonquins of Barrier Lake and Ojibwa. My name is Monique Manache. I'm a member of the Algonquins of Barrier Lake. Welcome to our unceded, unsurrendered Algonquin territory. So I was wondering what to say, and I thought of a story. So I'm going to tell you a short story. I won't make it long. And it's another creation story. We have lots. We have quite a number. We, you know, change it every day. So this time, a woman and a man were watching the earth. And they're looking down and they're really interested and they're saying, wow, look at that, look at all these things that are going on. And they watch for a long, long time. And finally they decided, we want to go live there. But how do we get there? So they talked to a lot of different ones up where they were. And they said, how do we get there, how do we get there? So finally they spoke to the spider. And they said, can you help us get to the earth, we want to go there. And she said, okay, I'll make a basket and I'll lower you down using my basket. And they said, oh, that's a great idea, we'll climb in. And they said, okay. So she's lowering them down. She said, just don't look over the side, because of course they fall out. So they're being lowered and lowered, probably standing too close to them. So they said, oh, there's a chair, I'll sit down. It's a little longer story than I anticipated. So after a while, they couldn't stand it anymore. And of course, you know what they did? They looked over the side, they fell out of the basket. So they fell and they fell and they fell. And finally, they landed in a tree. And they're sitting in this tree, and you know, trees used to be really tall, right? You know? They were big. Trees used to be big. So there they are at the top of the tree, and they don't know what to do. Well, here we are on top of the tree. And they see some animals go by. So they're thinking, well, maybe one of these animals can help us. So first they saw a lynx. And they said, hey, Manu, lynx, can you help us? Can you help us get out of this tree? And you know what cats are like, right? They're like, yeah, right. Yeah. I got serious cat business going on here, you know. And off went the lynx. And then a little while later, there was a deer. And the deer was going by. And they're saying, deer, can you help us? Can you help us get out of this tree? And the deer's like, look at my hooves. I can't climb trees. Oh, yeah, I can't climb trees. So off went the deer, and a bunch of animals went by. And then finally a bear came along, and they said to the bear, can you help us get out of here? Can you help us climb down and get down from this tree? And the bear looked at them, and she thought, humans. So she said, okay, I'll help you. So if you're ever running away from a bear, don't climb a tree. Because bears can climb trees. So up came the bear, and in my story, she was able to take both of them at once because she was a pretty strong bear. So she gets them down to the earth, and now they're on the earth. And like, this is great, we're on the earth. What do we do now? So the earth's like, oh, humans, the bear, she's, okay, come on. So she showed us how to live, what to eat, where to sleep, how to stay warm. You know, bears are the only animals that when they're sick, they search for medicine. They know how to find medicine plants. And the bears taught that to the human beings. That's how we know. And anything a bear can eat, we can eat. And if you look at a bear's skeleton, or if you look at a bear's footprint, a paw print, it looks remarkably like a human being's. And their skeleton is very similar to a human being's. So in my community, we see the bear as our sister or brother, and we don't hunt bear. Because for us, they were the original teachers. That's why there are so many in my community who are bear clan, and we consider that a medicine clan. Because that's where we got our start, is from the bear. So I was thinking about this, you know, and I've learned so much become, I'm horrified by what I have learned in the last couple of days. Of the mining and everything going on, I'm appalled. And I mean, where I was scared before, now it's like sheer terror. I'm just, you know. And so I'm really pleased and thrilled that there are people here like you who are fighting this. And knowing that I'm not alone, my community is not alone, that there are people like the bear who will help us, who know that what is happening to the Mother Earth is wrong. And so I think Joan is a leader amongst those. And I'm very, very honored to be here tonight to tell you that little story and to open this space for you.
And just before we go any further, I'd like to invite Fernanda Gutierrez, who is the director of this place, to explain a little bit about what it is and why it is here.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I don't know if this is the first time that you are here. It's good. Better play that. So this is the Social Innovation Workshop. And we are very excited to partner with Octopus Books for this book launch that are related to what we do. So this is a collaborative space where we try to promote social innovation, and we also help different projects to be developed. And we hope to be a hub where different communities can gather together. We have the academic, we have the students and professors from the Social Innovation School at St. Paul University, but also we have people like you that are interested in about how to make this world a little bit better, how to propose social change, social transformation. So that's why we are very excited that you are here. And if you want to know more a little bit about us, or if you want to come and visit and work here one day, because we are also a co-working space, you are welcome. At the end, we have some postcards. Take one, send us an email, and you said that you were here today at the Octopus Books and you want to come. And I'm offering tonight, because it's Friday and we are all happy, one day of using the space. So you can come for free one day and just to see how it feels, the vibe, how it is. So just what you need to do is to go and grab one of our postcards and send us an email and say, I was there and I want to know more about you. And thank you very much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Fernanda. And now, I would like to welcome Joan Kujak. The author of Unearthing Justice.
Hi.
And we're going to have a little conversation here. And then I'm going to abandon this chair and invite Ariel Duranger, Ariel Jekwe Duranger from Athabasca Chipewyan and First Nation, Indigenous Climate Action, Dennis Othene, activist and community organizer and international organizer, to come and join Joan for another conversation about whatever they want to talk about. But first, we want to talk about the book, if that's okay. I think that's what people are expecting, actually. So maybe the first biggest question is, how did you come to write this book? I mean, after you've written other books, some of them are very focused on particular issues about working at the bell. Others are more sort of almost like textbooks about community organizing. How did this happen?
Well, I think I wanted to write down what I learned about mining and organizing before I forgot it all. Mike Barlow at one point said to me, you've got to write about this because if you don't, you're going to forget it. And she said, it's a good way to organize what you already know. And it's true. I mean, I think I started writing the book when I moved to Sudbury in 1970. And we moved, my then husband Don and I moved there because we wanted to learn from the people who were involved in the labor movement, particularly a man named Weir Reed, who was an organizer with the Mine Mill Union, and the education director, actually. And it was so awful. I mean, Sudbury was about just black rock then, 100 years of mining and smelting. And for 80,000 kilometers, a whole area was poisoned. And over time, there have been scientists who've been spending an enormous amount of work trying to figure out how you regreen this, partly for public relations reasons and partly because people care, right? Like they really want to make it different. And they have. They've lined and put plastic on it in places to hold the soil in place. And then I heard the other day that they've actually managed to regreen 3,500 square kilometers of Sudbury with this regreening. It's the same size as the tailings impoundment, the Central Management Tailings Facility, which is one of four in the area, which can never be reclaimed. And I didn't even know what tailings were when I moved to Sudbury, Jamie. I crammed about mining technical stuff when I applied to work at Mining Watch. And I suddenly realized that mining was a waste management industry, and what was left behind was much more significant than even the biggest nickel deposit in probably the world. That for everything they took out, and the companies now say $1 trillion worth of wealth, they had left behind this incredible amount of damage. Most of the workers, when I moved there, couldn't even live past their retirement date because they died as soon as they retired. And two-thirds of the workers were leaving on disability. And as you learn that, it feeds into your being. And I love the city. I had lots of fun there. We swam in Ramsey Lake. I had a garden. I dug tailings into it. But by the time I went to work at Mining Watch, you're just so shaped by that. And then in Mining Watch, as you'll remember, Jamie's actually, when people talk about me being the founder of Mining Watch, Jamie is. There's a whole bunch of people before it even started that were trying to plan how they were going to do it. And they hired me to do the work they did. And we worked together 20 years almost. We've worked together for 20 years. I was 10 years at Mining Watch. And during that time, we just learned so much. We learned so much, and it needed to be told, you know? Like, there are stories about mining in other countries and Canada's role as an international predator in mining, but frankly, there isn't very much, except written by the industry, about mining in Canada. And it is a terrible story. It's a terrible story. And it needs to be told, and our colleagues in other countries that are battling these predatory companies need to have that information. The last little bit of this very long answer to your question was that 2 years ago, Donna Ashimuk came to me and asked me to help her understand mining. And I couldn't figure out how to do that, so I thought maybe I better write the book. So thank you, Donna. And I want to also just take a minute before we go further to thank some other people. Nicole Burton, who has done the illustrations for the book and did the cover, is at the back, and she's selling prints and comics and stuff. Thank you for coming. I want to thank John from Kitchimeksik and Inuit. I think I got that right, or close. Who's here for the wonderful foreword that he wrote for the book and the mentorship he's given me over the years on mining issues. And I want to thank all of you who are my friends and colleagues and compañeros for the work we've done together and what I've learned from you. So I just want to say that to start.
Thank you.
We brief her on the next dance.
No, please don't. I mean, I'm only here to get you to talk.
You're the straight man.
And to provide an extra feedback.
Literally.
I can talk really loudly, if that's better. But you can have the microphone.
It's not echoing with me, is it? Okay, it's a two mic sign.
So the whole intimate conversation thing over the microphone is not going to...
Well, shout at me instead.
So, yeah, I mean, you've talked about all of these things that nobody knows. I mean, there are lots of stories about mining, about how mining built Canada. And you've mentioned, you know, some of the upfront, well, really obvious, the tailings piles. I mean, they're obvious if you go up to them. They're not obvious from here. They're not obvious from Toronto. They're obvious if you're there. And the human costs as well. But maybe I'd ask you a little bit more. You know, you've visited communities across the country in the course of your work with Mining Watch and in the course of your post-Mining Watch work, because she hasn't stopped working, folks. She's kept at it. And maybe tell us a little bit more about the kinds of experiences that you see communities when you visit. What are they going through? Whether it's, you know, whether it's the prospect of exploration and prospectors coming in, you know, drilling and trenching in their land. Whether it's communities trying to figure out how to patch things together with an abandoned mine in their watershed, and everything in between. You know, there's a lot there. Maybe just give us a couple of
Sure, I'll be glad to do that. One of the things I realized early on is that communities are really different depending on the stage of mining that they're dealing with. So in Sudbury, we were dealing with a mine that had been mines, like 25 mines, the smelter, refineries, infrastructure, that had been there for 100 years. But in that community, if you were Anishinaabe, you would remember coming home and seeing your home burnt to the ground by prospectors. You would maybe remember from your grandparents' stories when you could fish in the lakes and play in the woods. It was St. Anne of the Pines when the Francophones first came there, Francophones first came there when the railroad went through. And before that, it was a gathering place for berries and stuff. So the experience of the Anishinaabe people who lived there was really, really different than the settlers who come in. And one of the things that happens is when the settlers arrive, I mean, like my own people didn't come to Sudbury at that time, but most of them came because they were fleeing persecution in Europe, often at the hands of their own lord or something, right? Or a civil war. And they're just desperate when they get there to make their own community. And the process of doing that means that you don't pay attention to the people who got displaced. They get disappeared. And that happens over and over and over again. In some places, they're walled communities now, and you go internationally, and the place where the miners, the people from the mining company live, are in a walled community. So if you're in a place where there's been mining for a long time, no, people don't remember or hear the stories. Those are all gone. And the way in which you deal with the mining company is with people are grateful that they have jobs. They can't find out what's happening like me. They don't even know there's tailings, right? The slimes, as they call them. And they don't understand the cost of what they take for granted. You know, most of us don't. So organizing around mining in a place like Sudbury is mostly around labor issues. We made a number of attempts, I talk about in the book, to organize around soil contamination, and we were fought even by the local food committee because they didn't want anybody to know that maybe it was bad to grow vegetables there, including me. I mean, I fed my family from this tailings contaminated garden. So it's really different, and that for the communities, what they go through is labor issues, really. Boom and bust and all sorts of issues like that. For people who are first dealing with a mine, they're usually these days there's some kind of rush going on, and there's a whole lot of people who are, well, the community gets really divided really fast. The company comes in and says, we've got the biggest gold, lithium, copper, whatever deposit in the world. You're all going to get rich. There will be hundreds of jobs, and everybody's going to do really well. And if the community is one that's already been seriously dispossessed and disorganized, which is an awful lot of rural communities these days, especially indigenous ones, then people think, yeah, maybe. And if they don't think it, they'll make sure. The government will send in a mining advisor who tells you, well, yeah, oh, and they're paid to do that. And the Ring of Fire in Northern Ontario, all those communities got a mining advisor. What they needed was community organizers. What they got was a mining advisor. And those people help divide the community further. And then there's people who care about the land, who are worried about whether the company is telling the truth. And they may be in the majority, but they often can't get access to the information they need. Like Jamie will remember, and some of you might, when the Victor mine was being planned up in Attawapiskat, near Attawapiskat, we kept trying to get people from the diamond mines in the Northwest Territories into those communities to tell people about what they were experiencing with the diamond mines in the Northwest Territories. And they were not allowed in. We managed to convince the chief that some people should go, and a couple of people from the north went, and the people in Attawapiskat loved them, and the next day they told De Beers to get lost. Now that changed, but they told De Beers to get out and stop putting the deadlines on them, and they were going to deal with it. So John could certainly tell you a million stories about that kind of thing. So, it's really hard. I mean, most of the time when I do talks now, I'll say to people, I'm so sorry you had to become a mining activist. Denis and France are over there. They live in Grenville-sur-la-Rouge. And people's lives get completely turned upside down because these jerks come in speculating and deciding that they're going to get rich on those people. And they make their lives misery for years and years and years when there's not even enough stuff there to make it worth a minute of their time. So that kind of stuff makes me incredibly angry. And you see more and more and more of this mining investor stuff. They're not really mining the mineral. They're mining investors and paying themselves well. The man who delivers my newspaper in the morning is from Ghana, from Obuasi. And his whole life has been a wreck. 4,000 years of gold mining that was small scale and done in a respectful way, and Canadian companies and others come in and just scoop out all the gold in a couple of years. And if there is something, that's what's going to happen. If there isn't, then the people are going to resist. And it becomes your life. I want to read, actually, a little bit from the book. Daniel Ishini was one of my heroes. He was the chief negotiator for the Innu at Voisey's Bay. And when we started, Daniel and some of the other Innu people were trying to stop the Voisey's Bay development, and they had to give in. They finally ended up just negotiating, and Daniel was the chief negotiator for the Innu. It meant spending weeks and months away from home in Ottawa with his team, negotiating with the company, negotiating with the government. While they're away, people gossip, there's problems at home, their leadership is gone. I mean, it's awful, right? And Daniel community said that they would help Mining Watch have its first consultation with Indigenous people about what we should do. And Mining Watch has done that ever since, right? I mean, that's what we did. Daniel died very young of heart failure because he was totally worn out by what happened. But what he said at that meeting was, as I'm sure you all know very well, dealing with industrial developments such as mines involves much more than protesting. It also involves participating in environmental assessments, attending co-management meetings, and having big arguments with governments over things like the definition of consultation. I have a lot of experience in these matters, but I wish it weren't so. I wish I had never heard of these things that I'm going to talk to you about. I wish I could use my time to try to solve the problems of my community instead of always fighting these developments. This takes up a lot of my time, time that I could be spending with my family and friends in the community or in the country. David Spirla, who works with a lot of communities in Northern Ontario, says that mining companies have no business going into any of these communities because they've got too many problems already. And I agree with him completely. Do you want another story? Because I could talk about abandoned mines, and the one I just there's 10,000 abandoned mines in Canada, and a lot of them are a lot of them aren't major, but some of them are just so awful they make your hair stand on end. And the worst one, I think, is the giant mine in Yellowknife, which has 237,000 tons of arsenic trioxide buried underground. Well, it's in the shafts and drifts of the old mines. The mine only operated from 1946 to 1996, and even then it was interrupted. But it was in the gold was in arsenopyrite ore, so in order to get at the gold, they had to heat the rock, smash it up, and then heat the rock, and the arsenic trioxide is what's left. I have no friggin' idea what to do with it. It's in the drifts and the shafts. They can't remove it because it's too dangerous to the workers and to the community. Arsenic is like radioactivity in that it's tasteless, odorless, and you don't really know it's there most of the time. And so they've come up with a plan to freeze it in place. They're creating a block of permafrost around this stuff that's going to have to be in place forever. And it took, I talk about the story in the book, Kevin O'Reilly and a couple of his buddies decades to get anybody to pay attention to this. And they're now freezing in place because they don't know what else to do. And what Kevin and the rest of them had to fight for was that this should only be the first phase, and the second phase should be that the government tries to figure out what to do with the arsenic. Go figure, right? We've got arsenic under the mines in Red Lake. There's arsenic under almost any of the old gold mines where they roasted the ore. So for communities dealing with that, and they're usually dealing with cancers, quite a few, they're usually dealing with people who don't want them to talk about it because it'll ruin their property values. And there's people who are desperate about it. So it's a real mix all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the giant mine is an amazing story. And just a little editorial. I think one of the benefits, if you will, of this astonishing story is that there's now been some really interesting work done on documenting it and on really looking at the social impacts and the emotional and cultural and mental dimensions of this, because of course this was not it's not always a gold mine. It was only a gold mine from 1936 onwards.
46.
And before that, it was a prime blueberry area.
Yeah.
It was not where people lived. It was where they went to gather blueberries in the late summer. And that's what the Dene people there know the place as. And so part of what people have been doing is trying to rescue that memory and keep it present through this now global world-class toxic waste site, and trying to figure out, you know, again, really, really interesting people, both from within the community and from outside, working together to try and figure out how do you come to terms with this, the fact that people there will be living this for the rest of their lives and for generations, while the people who created that situation are long gone. And this is a refrain in indigenous communities pretty much everywhere. You know, whatever this project is, you know, it may be long term from the point of view of the investor, that maybe going for decades, maybe even a century. For people who've been there for thousands of years and who are not planning on going anywhere ever, it's a whole different kettle of fish. But and the thing I wanted to ask you about, I mean, this is something we've talked about ourselves, but the whole notion that people from outside have any claim to what's there, that they have any sort of legitimacy to ownership or to exploitation or to extraction of what is there and what people are living with and living on and living from in their own lives. So maybe you can react to that.
Yeah. mining is the cutting edge of colonialism. I mean, and we mine in different ways. I mean, I talk about metal and diamond mining in the book. But industrial agriculture is also a form of mining. It mines the soil. And there's many, you know, fossil fuels is another one, and I don't talk about fossil fuels, but it's what happens is that the people who want to extract that thing, whether it's furs or fish or metals, lay claim to it and feel it's their right once they've laid the claim to take it, and they don't have any regard generally for the people whose livelihood it is and was. And in mining, that's called free entry. Once you stake the land, stake the claim, you have established your right in Canadian law to go right to the development of the mine and the production of it, with some small steps in between. But most provinces and territories allow free entry. That's what they have. And the mineral rights are severed from the surface rights. And when Canada talks about exporting, it's mineral policies and its mining laws to other countries, usually what they're talking about is that. It's the severing of the mineral rights from the surface rights and that right to just keep on going. So it's the moment for First Nations and Inuit people and Métis when the third party interest is established on the land. Like why? What right do they have to be there? What right do they have to be there? And so there is one case in the Yukon that actually said they can't just do that. But it hasn't, the Supreme Court of Canada refused to hear the case, and they might not have agreed anyway. So in some ways, you never know. But that's, that's what happens.
Mm. So, coming back to the book. The book is a thing. People can buy it and read it, and I hope they do. But you're also using it as a tool. What do you want people to do with this?
Well, I guess one of the things I don't do in the book is give you all the data that the industry does about how many jobs they create and how much minerals they produce and stuff. I figure you could find that easily enough. But what it does do is try to shift the discourse around how we talk about extraction and mining. And what I'd like people to be able, it's a heavy book, eh? It's a tome. But Nicole has made it a lot more readable, and the design that Beach Between the Lines did is made it not look like an academic text. So I'm very appreciative of that. I really like it. You don't have to read the whole thing, but what I would really like is if people tried to inform themselves with it, if people could use it when they're trying to, in their middle of struggles, and some people here have, you know, read the book and can probably say whether they can do that or not. We're not really, most of us are pretty illiterate, eh? We don't read much, and it's hard to get through something like this. So I don't think anybody has to read the whole thing. I think what you need to do is read the introduction and the conclusion, and as you need certain things, look through it, and maybe Nicole's drawing will tell you everything you need to know about a particular part. What I've been trying to do is go around and help communities out. I've got a fair amount of knowledge I accumulated over this time, and if I can be useful to people who are struggling with mining in one form or another, then I'll be glad to do it. For a number of years, I taught with Justin Kanitas over there a course at Queen's Law on mining law policy and communities. It actually provided the table of contents for the book. And I think, you know, if I can help teach from it, if you can use it if you're a teacher, then please do. I just really want it out there where it's being useful, and if I can be of use, I want to do that. I'm getting old, right? I might as well be useful for someone.
Okay, but when you go to promote the book, when you go on tour, you're not just going to independent bookstores in random places and trying to sell books, right?
No, I'm trying to change the discourse.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, even some of the places that you've been since the book came out not very long ago.
Okay, well, some people know how to use me better than others, right? So Nova Scotia, they really knew how. They're facing gold mining up in the hills from the coast, and the industry is trying to promote itself, and the government is all on side about making Nova Scotia a mining center again. I mean, all they've had is some failed coal mines. They're the place where Westray happened, and now they're talking gold. And there's this Australian company that thinks it's going to strike it rich in these deposits. And it's creating utter chaos for everybody, the Mi'kmaq who lived there before and the settlers who live there now. And so when I went out there, they knew what they wanted. They wanted me to say the things about mining that they felt they wouldn't get a voice for. So they had journalists set it up so that, like Joan Baxter, write about gold mining. They had me sit in a couple of strategy sessions. I didn't lead them because I'm not, but I can add to it. There was a series of broadcasts, 10-minute broadcasts on the CBC in the morning where they had Sean Kirby, who was with the Mining Association of Nova Scotia, speak first. And he did the usual, lots of jobs, and it's just going to get rich, and it's going to be a mine. It was incredible. Every cliche in the book. And then they had me on, and I sort of very calmly sort of went through how that wasn't true. And then they had the minister on, and he didn't know anything, and it was so funny. So, I mean, that kind of stuff. They had a demonstration, and it was beautiful. There was a gold show. They were trying to sell Nova Scotia to investors, and it was cold and miserable, but there was 100 people outside, and they had a lovely demonstration, and I got to say a few words at it near the end. But it was, you know, it was just a great opportunity, and I always stay with people because that way you're really getting a chance to talk over meals and stuff. So that was a wonderful trip. And I, on the other hand, I went to Winnipeg. I'd still be looking for the venue if I hadn't had my nephew come with me. And 20 people turned out, and I think they sold 10 books. I mean, it just didn't work very well, and, you know, nobody knew how to use me. Yeah. And so I think that I'll probably go back. I hope they figure it out, because I can be useful, you know, and that's what you want to be.
Mm-hmm. So... Do you have any?
Are we keeping you?
No, I just want to go on. I yak on.
Oh,
bedtime's coming soon.
No, I didn't. That is the problem with traveling.
Do you have any... Before I ask that, I wanted to ask you... Monique actually brought this up very appropriately. You know, the kinds of things that we're talking about, the impacts and the effects on people's lives, whether physically, economically, psychically, can be terrifying, immobilizing. And Monique also talked about how that didn't have to be immobilizing. It can't stop being terrifying, but it doesn't have to be immobilizing. And I wanted to ask you how you see that. How do you see other people dealing with that, and how do you deal with that sense of the enormity of what we're up against?
Oh gosh.
Just a little light discussion here.
Well, frankly, human beings have been up against this kind of stuff for a long time now, right? And some people have already been through an version of the apocalypse. And I find myself thinking, you'd be a fool not to be a pessimist about what's going on, right? But there's hope is a different thing. That Elizabeth May actually likes to say that, well, dandelions poke through concrete. I think that's a really good image, you know? And you get, the thing about being involved in this kind of work is you meet the most wonderful people in the world. And people being the most wonderful. I mean, we can all be jerks, right? I mean, we can all be absolute assholes. But there's something about working for things you believe in with other people that is an incredible gift. And when it gets really awful is the kind of internecine struggles that happen in communities, the kind of stuff that gets fed by the mining companies. And then when that gets really ugly, I've been in those struggles in different times. It really does just feed despair. Then you need to find who your real friends are. And the other thing I think I'd like to say to people in this room is if you think you're in this struggle for your life, you can take a couple of years off. You know, you don't have to just be butting your head against a stone wall all the time. And the other thing is, if the whole thing depends on you holding together, then it's not going to hold together. That it needs, you need a lot of other people. Unless we're building movements, unless we're building ways to support each other, we're not doing the right thing. And that we need to find out how to do that. And I guess the other thing I want to say is being tired isn't the same thing as burnout. I've been really, really, really tired. But the only place I ever got burnt out was when I worked for Bell Telephone. And that was a different thing. I was at work and I had to do something I couldn't stand doing and I started crying and I didn't stop for 3 weeks. That's burnout. But when you do the things you believe in, you can get exhausted. That you need to respect, and you need to say, I'm too tired. Somebody has to pick up this burden and carry it for a while. I cannot keep going. Because you're not going to be any use to anybody if all you're doing is crying. I cry when I'm exhausted. So I think that we need to be kind to one another, because that's... Kindness is actually a short shrift in a lot of these organizations. People are very harsh with each other, but I gotta say, I think that kindness is the thing that matters the most. You know, my daughter's here, and she's an incredibly kind person. She's a lot of other things too, but
she's her other
She's a roller derby. Roller derby star. Anyway, I just, I think that what keeps you going in a way is kindness. What keeps you going is kindness and understanding and allowing people space to fall apart once in a while. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's much help, but that's what I think.
I think it is, because, you know, when you're making steel and you want to make it less brittle, the process is called tempering.
Oh, Jenny, so, that's so brilliant.
So, but just maybe for the last few minutes before we get Ariel to come up and prolong this a little bit further, and I hope in some of the same
yeah.
directions. But is there any favorite stories that you'd like to pull out that you haven't mentioned?
They're in the book, so you're going to have to read it. But I think I end it with.
I thought you might read something.
Oh, well, I did. I read Daniel.
Okay.
What I'm most pleased about actually is the story I end it with is the story of the Raven coal mine, which is on Vancouver Island. Vancouver Island is largely made up of coal, so they've got a long history of coal mining. But in recent years, that's changed a lot, and the fishery is really, really important. And they got hammered when the lumber industry fell apart. And they spent millions of dollars, the First Nations there and the Indigenous people and First Nations there, as well as the settler communities, reconfiguring their economy. What were they going to do with this mess that they had inherited from the coal mining ending and the lumbering industry ending? And they came up with all sorts of plans. It must have cost millions of dollars in those big community consultations, never been part of it. There was plans of the yin-yang. You know, I think I've got them on my shelves someplace. And they're like miles of documents. And they had a plan. It was based on some shellfish aquaculture on the coast, and which was huge and bringing in lots of money. They had salmon and trout. They were talking about wood value-added production. They had all sorts of organic gardens going on and wineries and distilleries, and they had a whole plan for a different way of configuring their economy. And then this freaking coal company comes in, and we knew them. They were old Placer Dome guys, James O'Rourke. And they came in and they said, oh, we're going to start a coal mine. It'll create 250 jobs and billions in GDP. And so all of a sudden, the people were just, their whole lives were taken up with trying to stop these guys. And they did it. They did it. They had thousands of people come out to the environmental assessment process. The fire marshals had to close them down because there were so many people. They had people writing letters. They had a website. They did all the things we all do. They tried all the legal things they could. It became the first mine ever turned down by the BC Environmental Assessment Office. So, I mean, that's decades. There have been others turned down since, and some of those stories are in there too. The Ajax mine near Kamloops, the Chilcotin have spent 30 years fighting the new Prosperity mine that's owned by Taseko, one of the most despicable companies in the country.
But which the province has approved.
Yeah, the province approved, but the feds turned it down twice. The company sued the feds. I mean, it just goes on and on, but they've stopped it. So there's all these stories. And there's a lot of them, actually. And one of the biggest things is if you delay it, it's probably going to fall apart. So if you can delay it long enough, it'll probably go away. So I just to let you know that. Anyway, thanks, Joan.
Thanks, Joan.
I think that might be better.
This one's like radioactive or something.
I think it's having the two mics on. They're echoing.
So,
are you going to introduce her? You did already.
Well, I sort of did. So, but I'd like to welcome Ariel Duranger from
what we call Northern Alberta from Treaty 8 territory, to join Joan for another little discussion. Thank you. Thank you for coming all this way.
Well, I'm just so honored that you wanted to be here, Ariel. It's wonderful. We haven't talked. This is the first time we've talked with each other. So I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about what you do.
I'm going to introduce myself first. Ik anade dene sotlane ta ael se ekwe huche, derange betsi ni hasli. I want to thank Monique for the greeting and inviting us all into your territory. And on that, I just want to also say that like it's really great to have Monique here and to acknowledge lands and territories, but I encourage you all to read the Yellowhead Institute's Land Back piece recently, that we have to do more than just acknowledgement. And then part of this unearthing justice and talking about mining is around how we manage and care for our lands and territories. And it's about how we value and center the values of what is in the public's interests. And Indigenous communities have a history of managing our lands and territories in a much more reciprocal with nature way. So, you know, land back. So what do? It was a very short intro. So I worked for many years. I was actually having some conversations with Monique, who I only met tonight as well. So in my early 20s, I was a land claims, specific land claims and treaty land entitlement researcher. I worked for the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations. And over the course of that time, I learned more about the history of this country and the appropriation of lands and territories from Indigenous communities than you can from any textbook in the world, probably, maybe. I spent a lot of time in the National Archives, in the Archives of Indian Northern Affairs, but most of my learning took place in community. And what I learned made me very, very frustrated and angry. I come from a long line of activists. Dene people are notorious for being quite oppositional to the colonial structures. And my parents, you know, I always make a joke that I was born into activism, but I really was. In 1979, my family was forcibly removed from our traditional territory in northern Saskatchewan to make way for uranium mining. At gunpoint, armed security of El Dorado Mining Company. And from that point on, we moved into Regina, Saskatchewan, where my mom got a job, and I make another joke that arts and crafts for me growing up were making protest placard signs and helping come up with new chants. And so I come by this work honestly, but I really think my deep learning and passion for what I do now comes from the time that I spent really digging deep and understanding how the colonial government not only tried to erase our histories from the history books, but erased and erase our people from the landscapes, but tried to devalue and demonize Indigenous cosmology, ideology, governance, economics, education, you know, medicine, biology, geology, all of the sciences. Those things existed in our communities, and as we get closer, there's like this interesting loop circle that's coming. You know, we're finding that there was like sort of a microbiology and astronomy that was being developed and procured within our communities before colonization. And so over the years, I was getting really disenchanted and by the government, and I really wanted to know what was happening in my own people's territory, because I was living in southern Saskatchewan, but my home territory is northern Saskatchewan, northern Alberta. And I learned about the Alberta tar sands. So the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation comes from downstream of the Alberta tar sands. And when I learned about how bad things had gotten, not that I didn't know that there was oil extraction, but from the time that I was a child to my early 20s, the expansion took off. And I hadn't really spent a lot of time up there. And I had this moment where I hadn't been there for maybe close to 10 years, and I went up and my aunt is just like, oh my God, when you see it, your mind's gonna be blown. it's crazy. And we start driving from the city of Fort McMurray to the reservation of Fort McKay First Nation, just north of Fort McMurray. And I remember that doing that drive many times as a kid. We used to go camping out there, go hunting, fishing, trapping up there. And I remember seeing like Syncrude and Suncor, but they were kind of behind a tree line and they were just like smoking smokestacks, not a lot. And I remember we pull up to what is now known as the Syncrude Loop up there, just before you take the highway to Fort McKay. And I see devastation. And it was, you know, I don't know if any of you have seen Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
You know, Mordor, when they like come upon Mordor. That was literally like what I saw. But for me, it hit me so much deeper because I always try to tell a story without crying. I'm gonna try. I grew up with an understanding that the trees and the rivers and all of the animals, from the fish to the lynx to the muskrats to the moose and the bison, the beaver and the eagles and the cranes and the geese, they are all your relatives. To every blade of grass, they are your family. And you speak to them and you have relations with them and you learn from them. And they nurture you and you have to have a reciprocal relationship. So when you come over this thing and you see that entire landscape, that is your family, and it is literally turned into dust, it hit me so hard that I remember feeling like I couldn't breathe as my aunt just talked about how big the industry was getting in the front seat of the car. And I remember I got to the point where my ears start ringing and I can't breathe and I'm sitting in the back of the car and I'm just like, and it was that moment that I realized that I could not do anything else but try and stop this. And I dedicated, and I have dedicated my entire life to stopping this psychosis of us validating and vindicating this as okay. To destroy the natural world is to destroy ourselves. And so for the last 15 years, I have spent my life organizing in my communities, organizing with environmental justice organizations, organizing at the international level within the UNFCCC processes to try and bring light to the fact that we cannot continue this blind action to destroy ourselves by destroying the planet. And most recently, in the last 3 years, I've started an organization called Indigenous Climate Action, which focuses on empowering our communities to recognize that we are our own experts. We are biologists, geologists. We are, you know, ecologists and hydrologists. And we have the expertise in our communities. We have the solutions and the answers that we have maintained through millennia of knowledge exchanges between our generations to share those relationships that bring us closer to closing that gap and alleviating us of the psychosis that has allowed us to get to the place we're at today.
Whoa.
Kind of speechless, actually. maybe you could talk a little bit about how you work. I think that a lot of us who organize talk about organizing, but it's kind of mystified. So could you give us some stories? Yeah.
I think like how we work, and particularly in these types of movement spaces, is really, I feel like there's been like this evolution. Like first, I always think about like the evolution of when you realize there's a problem, you're like, okay, there's a problem, and you accept that there's a problem, and then sometimes you get angry about the problem, and then you're like, oh, I'm so angry about that problem, I want to smash something, you get angry, and then sometimes you get really sad, and then you're just like, oh, I can't fix it. And then you're like, okay, no, I'm going to do something. And then you start to like really like become meticulous and look at it from all the different angles. And then towards the end, you start to realize that the problem isn't that, like, it isn't necessarily that initial thing that you're even angry about. Sometimes it's like so much more deeper and insidious. And so for myself, I always talk about starting at zero. When I organize, I don't necessarily want to tackle the immediate issue that I think is the problem. So it's not like I want to stop the tar sands, but it's not like I want to stop the tar sands. Like when I first started this work, I was like, I gotta go shut down this project. I gotta go like that project. That's the one. I'm gonna smash it. I'm so angry. But now I feel like the issue that the way that I organize is first you have to open our eyes to that there is that problem. And then we have to open ourselves to believe that we have the power to do something. So we have to go through those cycles. And you have to nurture community. And one of the most radical things to do in this day and age of hyper-individuality and accumulation of wealth and, you know, really predicated on the ideologies of, like, colonization to come, take, you know, become rich and powerful, systems of white supremacy, is to nurture relationships and build community that is not reliant on those systems. So for me, organizing is building a counterculture. It's building that community of care that sees one another, that eats together, that has ceremony together, and that builds relationships so that when those moments of urgency come about, when those struggles to take down that project come, that you're not doing it as an individual. And when I heard your story about that first mine that got shut down, it happened because thousands of people showed up.
Yeah.
And that only happens when you build community. It doesn't happen from, like, you know, yelling at the government every 2 minutes. It doesn't happen from you writing a paper. I mean, those are all important. But it comes from the very basic of movement building, comes from building community and having relationships. And particularly when you think of indigenous communities, for myself, colonization, one of its first primary motives was divide and conquer.
Yeah.
And so the main mandate of my organization is how do we reignite and reestablish those networks of connectivity between our communities so that we can share our knowledge, share our skill sets, so that we can build a web of trust, so that when things start to fall, there's something to catch each other. And that is so critically important to how we build movements to stop injustices in whichever form that they come, is building those communities that are outside of the scope of reliance. And once those communities start to get bigger and bigger, that's when those systems that have held moments of power become weaker. It doesn't matter how much money they have, it doesn't matter how much land they claim to own. It's when those counter movements become so big that it doesn't matter, those systems of power that they have created themselves become weaker simply by numbers of people supporting each other to not be a part of those systems.
Wow. I'm going to suggest that we take questions from the audience. It's 8:30, and I think so. People have things they want to ask or things they want to say. Feroz.
My name is Feroz. I'm a member of the Permanent People's Tribunal on corporate exploitation in Southern Africa. The report recently came out. We took evidence from a whole range of people organizing in southern African countries, from Tanzania, Zambia, Mozambique, South Africa, Namibia, and so on. What I find really striking, and I'm new here in Canada, but what I find really fascinating is you might as well be talking about where I'm from.
Yeah.
Okay.
Colonization looks the same everywhere.
but I think that is really striking, because 10 years ago I was in Canada, and when I talked about exactly the same issue, there was silence. So there has been change. And I think it's due to the mobilizations that people like you have done. So it's a real tribute.
That's really true. Thank you.
Yeah. want to take up one of the things that you said, Joan. I'm glad you found a distinction between hope and pessimism. But then, you know, Eduardo Galeano said, let's postpone pessimism for better times. I wish we had had this book when we were taking hearings from all those communities across Southern Africa, because this is an extraordinarily important book. And sorry, Joe, I don't think people should just read the introduction. I'm sorry, you have to read it, and it is a pleasure to read. It is so well written, because it's written from a point of view of an organizer. And I think anyone who doesn't know about mining or who wants to know about its impact, this is an essential book. I wish I had bigger pockets, because it is a perfect book. But congratulations. I think this is an extraordinary achievement. And thank you for sharing your immense experience.
Thank you.
Things that struck me about what you've been saying for a long time is that we don't really need to mine. That in fact, most of what we have, we can recycle. And I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
We just went through 2 days of discussing this in great length at the Mining Watch conference on turning down the heat, which is about the need for metals for the new economy. And what really struck me, and I'm sure you want to comment on this too, is that most of that need is premised upon capitalism as usual, colonialism as usual. And if we were to take the things that Ariel's talking about in terms of how we restructure the world we live in, then that's a very different story. And the key one around it actually is electric vehicles. Yeah. They're all their projections are premised upon armaments as usual and electric vehicles for individuals. If you take those two things out of the equation, war and substitute public transit, then you've got a whole different set of needs, and that was really interesting. I do say in the book that we shouldn't mine any more gold, we shouldn't mine any more diamonds. We've got all the gold we could already use, it's been mined. And the only diamonds we need is industrial, and frankly, they can manufacture those synthetically. We shouldn't mine uranium. We should be healing those places that we've damaged already. And we shouldn't mine coal. So if you take those right out of the picture, you've got a whole different picture already.
I mean, kind of hit the nail on the head. It's like a lot of the reason why we're continuing to mine and extract resources is for this new economy that's predicated on business as usual. And I think that some of the work that I've been doing at the UN level with bringing indigenous value systems and knowledge systems into the equation around developing solutions for technical advice for the implementation of the Paris Accord. is that we have to have different approaches than just trying to maintain status quo business as usual. And recycling does offer us opportunities to look at that, but if we're talking about continuing this culture, not just of capitalism, but of this disposability, that everything is disposable, like, you know, oh, it breaks, you just get a new one. These are not mentalities that a lot of indigenous communities have because of the fact that we have been impoverished, that we have lived on the subsets of the colonial capitalist structures. We've had to be industrious. We've had to naturally recycle and reduce and reuse in our communities because of access to those material goods. And so we can learn a lot about different ways of being through looking at different cultures and creating different value sets by bringing into those knowledge systems in. And I just think like the problem that we have as a society is that we're looking at creating solutions to the crisis and the problem within the confines of the very systems that created the problem. So in order for us to address it, we have to broaden our scope of what solutions look like and where they come from. And that comes from different cultures, different ways of relating to the land and the universe. It comes from nature. Like, nature has so many solutions, like the bear teaching the man where to eat and where to sleep. We have to listen to the words of the natural world that have spoken to so many people for so long that we've forgotten because we've been blinded by those systems. And I think those are naturally there. And I'm excited to see what happens. And I actually hope that, you know, pessimism can be for another day, because I am hopeful despite the fact that, you know, 11,000 scientists say we're doomed.
I'm going to suggest that we wrap it up and give people a chance to visit and talk with each other. I want to really thank Mining Watch for providing the food and drink, and Jamie for facilitating it, for Octopus Books, for going to all this work. Thank you, Greg and Lisa and Peju. And I want to thank Manik especially for the permission. I've done a bit of work at Barrier Lake, and I really, you know, what an effort people have put in for decades there. So thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you all for coming. Thank you.